7600 Northeast Gleason, or listen live on KBOO Radio, or view it on Open Signal Community Television.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Hello, welcome to the Coalition of Black Trades Unionists segment of Labor Radio, highlighting the works of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class, here on KBOO 90.7 FM, where the heart of the community comes alive 7 days a week. My name is Tina Turner Morfitt. I am a member of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Retirees Union, and the president of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. Tonight, I'm joined by my sisters in the struggle.
Good evening, this is Deborah Hall, soon to be retiree from American Federation of Teachers, and I'm currently at this time serving as the Secretary Treasurer for the Oregon Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. Happy New Year.
Hi, I'm Dr. Audrey Terrell. I am the Vice President of the Oregon Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, and I'm also President and CEO of the Dr. Audrey Terrell Institute, and I'm retired from the UAW staff out of Detroit.
And hello, my name is Nanette D. Carter Joffrey, and I am a proud union member of Service Employees International Union and a Home Care Council District 1 Director and also a Coalition of Black Trade Unionists member.
Happy New Year.
So tonight, our interview is with Graham Traynor, who is the newly elected president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. Welcome, Graham.
Thanks so much for having me.
So... tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Sure, happy to, and happy New Year to our listeners. As Tina mentioned, my name is Graham Traynor, and I've been recently elected. I'm humbled to have been elected in September as the newest and youngest ever president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, the State Federation of Labor Unions.
All right.
I was told that after the fact. I didn't realize it, but I was told that after the fact, so I had to mention it. And you know, I grew up in a rural Midwest, relatively conservative, not necessarily a pro-union family, but was taught the value of hard work and the dignity of all work at a really young age. My grandfather was a 40-plus year member of the UAW, still receiving his pension after having been retired for longer than he was ever a worker in the factory. My mother was a member of the Indiana State Teachers Association and a 42-year second grade teacher, retired about 4 years ago.
And so I was
in and around the kind of the working class struggle, but didn't necessarily have my first front row seat or exposure until a bit later. I went to college in Indiana and then ended up taking a job as a community organizer right out of college. And I was drawn to activism and fighting for something that was bigger than myself, and ended up as a conservation and environmental activist, actually. I was fighting for, I think land use issues in Indiana. I made sure that the local utility wasn't polluting the water with mercury. And I got a taste for activism in that moment. And one thing led to another. I ended up in Oregon and was proud to become the state director of Working America, which I think we'll talk about in a bit. But, I'm really proud to carry on the struggle and the legacy that Tom Chamberlain leaves. I was really fortunate to work with Tom for all but 3 months of his entire career as president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and really learned what ethical, powerful leadership, progressive leadership in the labor movement looks like and means. And I'm excited to just carry on that tradition in the next in the decades to come.
Well, sweet. So talk to us about being the director of Working America. How did that get you ready for your current position as president of the AFL-CIO.
Yeah, so Working America, for those of you who might not know, is the organization that's really for the working class, but folks that might not have a union on the job. They don't have the good fortune. They'd like to join one, but they don't necessarily have a union on the job. And so Working America was created out of a need by the labor movement to really grow our ranks and to expand our ability to communicate with voters and working people. And so with that in mind, a few years after its founding by the great Karen Nussbaum, who leaves a lasting legacy in our workers' movement as well, I was grateful to be hired as the Oregon director. And, you know, that really taught me, one, about the labor movement and sort of the priorities of the Oregon labor movement. But it also taught me about the fundamentals of organizing. Uh-huh. I'd already done community organizing, but I led literally a team of ground troops into communities around the state that were carrying the message of the working class struggle, fighting the fight of the labor movement, but in the streets.
Right.
And so during the legislative session, we would send canvassers into strategic targeted districts that were aimed at putting pressure on politicians to do the right thing by workers. And I could rattle off a million examples of that inaction experience that I got as director of Working America. And it really, at that point, I established really strong relationships with many in the labor movement, Tom obviously being kind of the one that comes to mind first. But I also, got a lead and direct a team that was just first and foremost activists. If you ask that group of people that I led for two and a half years, what they did for a living, they said, "I'm an activist." They were professional activists. And so that really lit a fire and really solidified my commitment to the worker struggle.
Well, yeah, and my memory of Working America was I was so elated at the fact that we had normal people out there, aside from union members, who were carrying the same message that we as union activists were carrying. Because there are times when people believe that we are somewhat elitist and when we try to bargain better contracts for ourselves. And so having the general public and going through Working America for me was really a benefit. Because again, it helped tell that story that we not only work for union workers, we were working for all workers.
Mm-hmm. And if I could just add one comment about Working America that I think is so powerful and really illustrates its significance. We have about 200,000 members of Working America still in Oregon. So these are folks that signed up as a Working America member on the doorstep from one of my team. So it literally creates the voting bloc that's bigger than any voting bloc outside of either major party in the state. So when we think about communicating a working class message and electoral work in the labor movement, we fold in the Working America membership.
Sure.
And we found that over the last three or four election cycles, Working America members, because we've communicated with them election cycle after election cycle, these folks are turning out at a greater rate than union members.
Right.
Union members already have a turnout edge.
Wow.
And Working America members are turning out at an even higher rate, and they're responding to our messages, and they're voting our way because we talk to them about economic populism and economic justice, right?
Sure. And these were things that they were living through. Mm-hmm. And so, so it was a benefit. Mm-hmm. All right. So talk to us about some of your goals. I know you've been in the position only for a short period of time. So what are going to be some of the major things you're going to be working on?
Sure. That is a big question, Tina. We've got a lot to tackle
in
as a
short
working class.
Period of time. I'm sorry.
But I'll just share a few thoughts that come to mind when you ask that question. We as an organization of state labor unions that represent public sector, private sector, federal sector, building trades, and really, it's hard to think of a part of the economy in Oregon that we don't represent workers in.
Right.
And we always also think about our role as a voice for all workers, not just union members. And so with that vision in mind, that sort of perspective on the organization and the significance, it's a really exciting time to be a union activist.
Right.
I mean, look at the collective action around us. You see, in 2018, the statistics around work stoppages are greater than any time, any year since 1986, where more workers took part. They took bold action on the shop floor, and nearly 500,000 workers did something about their economic conditions. Again, an instrumental year. And 2019 trends continue, I think, in a very similar fashion. You had, obviously, the UAW strike is a big symbol of this collective action. You have, you know, at one point, literally right around the time I was getting elected, it was around our convention in late September, you had three or four really significant sized groups of union members, whether it was the workers at Kaiser, the workers at Fred Meyer, Albertson, Safeway, and the university workers in our university system. All those workers were literally just about ready to go on strike all at once. They were willing to go to the mat for dignity and justice on the job. And so that's exciting, and it's gives me a lot of hope, but it's not enough. You know, that's not growing our movement alone. And so I think growth and coupling sort of this collective action that we see in contract fights with actual growth and strategic organizing is critical at this moment, I believe. I think, you know, more workers today would join a union if they could than at any point in the last 50 years. Union favorability is at a 50-year high. And the time is right. Sort of the economic conditions suggest that workers can't be pushed much more. And they're willing to do something about it. Now, we still have a rigged federal labor law structure. So it's going to be important to couple the strategy with a legislative strategy in Congress when the time allows for it to pass federal labor law, like the Protecting the Right to Organizing Act, the PRO Act, which is a critical piece of game-changing federal labor law legislation. So growth is key and has to be, you know, front and center. And I think a lot of our affiliates are doing just that, which is really, I take a lot of pride in. You know, we're also thinking a lot about, you know, what is the economy today look like for a worker that's different than it was 14 years ago when Tom took over. You know, we have an economy today that I would argue is more fissured, more precarious, more challenging, regardless of what all of these false economic statistics like to suggest. It's an economy that's not working for the vast majority of folks. And so so to say that, oh, everything's great because GDP numbers are through the roof, breaking records, and unemployment is at an all-time low is not the full picture.
No, it's not.
And so when I think about low-wage work, when I think about workers today, you know, I think about the driver for Grubhub or Postmates. I think about who is you know, falsely classified as an independent contractor, and the challenges they face in their, you know, kind of piecemeal approach to their work situation. I think about low wage workers at Fred Meyer, Safeway, and Albertsons that do have a contract, but still make poverty wages. And you know, they make a little bit more than the non-union sector side of that industry, but I still think about those types of workers. And so for us, I think what that means in sort of in terms of tangible action, I think it means that we have to have a legislative agenda, a policy strategy that really looks at today's economy and addresses it in a really thoughtful way. I think, you know, the misclassification of independent contractors is a big issue. And you saw California do a really bold thing when they passed Assembly Bill 5, which simplified and made a more fair test for deciding whether or not a worker is an independent contractor. Oregon's got to look at that. We've got to look at the use and abuse of non-compete agreements, which silence workers' voice and keep them from being able to work in their own communities and their own industries. We got to look at forced arbitration agreements where workers, unbeknownst to them, sign away their rights on day one. All of these trends in employment law that the corporate agenda are capitalizing on, the labor movement has to have a counter shot to. And so I think a legislative and policy agenda that keeps up with the 21st century economy is definitely front of mind. And then I gotta say, and I'd say this to any group. I wouldn't just say it in front of a CBTU audience. I think, you know, defining the way that we, redefining the way that we think about workers' issues is critical. You know, when I when I've been told by legislators that housing policy is out of the lane of a labor advocate, I gotta shake my head. If you can't connect the dots between housing instability and housing insecurity, and the working class struggle and the labor movement, I don't know what you're looking at. When you look out at the economy,
what they're doing is they're ignoring the working poor.
That's right. That's right. And I also, you know, I'm a white male. I recognize my privilege. I also think that, especially as a white male, it's important for us as an organization to lead on racial and gender justice work. And mm-hmm. I think you saw this work play out in the last legislative session when we tackled a really groundbreaking bill where we rewrote the statutes that give workers who face sexual harassment on the job much more tools, groundbreaking tools to deal with those types of challenges that, let's just face it, women face it a lot more often than anyone else.
Exactly.
So I think you just got to call a spade in that arena.
Right.
You know, when it comes to race and labor and how we move forward to make sure that we're a movement that is truly one that is that is looking hard and strategically, surgically at the economy about who the winners and losers are. I recognize people like me, people that look like me, are winners in this economy.
Sure.
And people that don't look like me are often on the losing end of the economic growth.
Sure, sure.
And so we've got to be really thoughtful about how we do our policy work, do our political work in a way that truly looks at the winners and losers of the economy and is always looking to capture an economy that brings up the folks that have traditionally lost more often. I think of farm worker collective bargaining. I think of how, you know, who was left behind by the National Labor Relations Act.
Right.
And how you get those rights to the folks that never had them to begin with. The
exactly.
people that put food on our table.
Right.
So anyway, those are just a few ideas of
Well,
just
I think you did a pretty good job of handling that really big question.
Yeah.
Can I just add this? Can I be heard?
Sure.
Can I just add this? As you were talking about, we as union activists and the things that we do, we... the CBTU participated in feeding the homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not a racial thing because most of the 90% of the people we fed were white people coming mm-hmm. through that are mm-hmm. homeless.
Mm-hmm.
But for us to be there as an organization, as part of union activists and feeding, not only one time, we did it for several days,
mm-hmm.
Going out, feeding, that's part of our interest, our concern on the well-being, if mm-hmm. people got homes, if they're being fed, mm-hmm. if they're being taken, do they have medical? I mean, so we encompass so much here. Mm-hmm. So
absolutely.
What you were saying, mm-hmm. it's about all of us and the mm-hmm. concerns of all of us. Mm-hmm. So I can appreciate what you said.
I appreciate that. And community service acts are just so critical to, you know, kind of the fabric and mm-hmm. the history of the labor movement. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, we need to do everything we can to help as many people as we can.
Yeah,
for sure.
So, Graham, this is Deborah Hall. AFL-CIO has constituency groups, which has brought us to the table and brought us together as a group, the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. Can you talk a little bit about the constituency groups? Because I don't know if a lot of union folks know that there are specific interests that you can get them involved in also mm-hmm. with your union work.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think CBTU, it seems like lately, especially the last couple of years, has been the most active constituency group in Oregon. I'm really mm-hmm. proud to have Tina on the board and continue to see that activism even in retirement.
You
know? But, you know, I think that, you know, an often under-told story about the labor movement and the AFL-CIO structure is the value and importance of constituency groups. As you said, Deborah, you know, constituency groups were intended to give any group of people or workers or union members space and value in the broader structures. You know, and I think that whether it's the A. Philip Randolph Institute, CBTU, the Latino Coalition for Latin American Advancement, the Coalition for Labor Union Women, constituencies that have traditionally been underserved or undervalued, I would argue, and I'll just admit, in the labor movement, those structures exist. And I think for any activist that might be listening that wanted to participate through their union in a constituency group, I'd always welcome those conversations. I would mm-hmm. love to have more constituency groups.
That's right. You guys, come on in, because there's room. There's a space for all of us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Come on.
So if you're just tuning in, this is the Oregon Coalition of Black Trade Unionists segment of Labor Radio. And our guest is Graham Traynor, who is the new president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. Again, thanks a lot. You want to briefly tell our members about the podcast?
I'd be happy to. You know, the Oregon AFL-CIO is the statewide federation of unions and the voice for all working people in the state. You know, we're always thinking about how to best connect with people and workers in the working class, you know, struggle. And I think over the years, we've attempted to, you know, to really experiment. And one of the things that over the last couple years, I believe it's about nearly 2 years, we've had a podcast where it's an Oregon-specific podcast focused at the struggles of the working class in Oregon. Just for example, the December podcast episode we do once a month. It's called The Voice of Oregon's Workers. You can find it on any of your iTunes apps
Android.
I'm close to. They say I'm close to a millennial, but sometimes I feel really old. but anyway, well, all those places you find your podcasts, apparently you're able to find them. That's what I'm told. But the December podcast episode highlighted the value of building trades apprenticeships.
Sure.
And it talked to the head of the building trades, who is also a person of color, the first person of color to ever lead the state building trades council.
Nice.
In Oregon. And one of the building trades training directors from, mm-hmm. it happened to be the cement masons.
Okay.
So they interviewed those two individuals about the value of apprenticeships and how important that is. We also have highlighted the history and sort of the radical past of May Day, around May Day. Mm-hmm. You know, we do our May episode. We've done audio from different panels we've had at conventions. So it's a really interesting once a month, 30 to 45 minutes opportunity to really get plugged in and understand a little bit more of those types of things that are happening in the labor movement that you might not otherwise know. So
before Sister Audrey goes to our announcement, I do want to thank you, our brother trainer, for being a part of a October training that we had here in conjunction with LIRC. And the training looked at something called critical race theory, and we will have other episodes of our show where we'll talk a little bit more about that. But I was really pleased that you came out and welcomed all of the participants to Oregon as we talked about this very heady subject. So, yeah. Sister Audrey.
Yeah, just quickly, and I'm so glad you talked about being community, this constituency group being actively, especially CBTU is so involved. So they work with me, because I work with youth now, mm-hmm. with the Dr. Audrey Terrell Institute, and we talk about not only getting jobs, union jobs. So, and this, in the past 72 hours, everybody's conversation is on what's happening over in Iran and sending troops over there. So I'd just like to highlight right now, just take a minute, highlight because the draft. We're not talking about it, but it's a real deal here. Wow. Because they're sending people over there. Well, somebody got to stay over here. So there are some things that I'd just like to highlight. If the draft were held today, there would be fewer reasons to excuse a man from service. It would be different from the one being held during the Vietnam War. It would be the most epical draft in history. So it says here that under the current draft law, a college student can have his induction postponed only until the end of the current semester. A senior can be postponed until the end of the full academic year. So you can't hide behind college anymore. If a draft was held today, local boards would better represent the communities they serve. So you would have the changes in the new draft law made in 1971 included the provisions that membership on the boards was required to be as representative as possible of racial and national origin of registrants in the area served by the board. So, but today they have this uniform national call ensures that men will be treated the same no matter what which board they're assigned to. So we got to check out this board. And another thing, just one or two more things about if we had a draft today, they would use a lottery to determine the order of call. A draft held today would use a lottery system that would spend only 1 year in the first priority for the draft. And let me just say, I'm talking about kids from 18 to 26 years of age. So they're not quite out of high school, a lot of them are. So each year after that, he would be placed in a succeeding lower priority group, and his liability for the draft would lessen accordingly. And then the last one, I want to iterate that before 1971, a draftee was not guaranteed a right, so some decisions whether a man would be drafted were now based on paperwork. Today, if a man wanted to appeal to his local board for an exemption of deferment, he would have to speak to them directly. So it's a little few changes in that. But I also want to reiterate about these women, okay? Selective service laws that is written now refers especially to male persons, as we all know. Ha-ha. We must register, and who would be drafted. Okay, let me just say this, that the Defense Secretary Ash Carter announced in December 3rd, 2015, the Department of Defense will lift all gender-based restrictions on military service starting January. So I just want to summarize this. The Selective Service, if given the mission and modest additional resources, is capable of registering and drafting women with the existing infrastructure. So I say to you all who are listening audience and to you, go on Google this information. It's on how the draft have changed since Vietnam. We want to be concerned. We want a thing to hit us like it's been hitting us in the last 72 hours, just one thing after another. Be prepared. Know what's happening. Know your rights, especially young people. I work with young people all the time, and I currently and always will try to keep them up to date as what we're doing. We're CBTU. We're union activists. We're concerned about our youth, their well-being. We're trying to get them union jobs. We're trying to get them into school if possible. But all I'm saying, we work hand in hand with the CBTU in educating our youth on the issues of today. And I love this broadcast because we do that.
Yes,
what's
we do.
Going on in the community? What's going on today? Things are happening so fast. Thank you, Madam President. I just want to add about our next meeting will be a monthly meeting of the Coalition of Black Trade Unions. Will be, let me turn the page here. Held on the second Tuesday of every month. Our meeting this month is on January the 14th, 2020. We meet at 6 p.m. at the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employee William Bill Lucy Building, located at 6025 East Burnside here in Portland. And our email address is orcbtu10@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. Join us in our evolving adventure of representing black union workers. Thank you, Madam President.
Sure thing. So before we sign off, I would like to invite our listeners to come check us out at the Dr. Martin Luther King celebration on January 20th at the Highland Church. Yes. This is something that is done every year. Mm-hmm. Come on by and talk to us. Sister Audrey can talk to you a little more about the draft.
Yes.
And we can also talk to you about the voter registration, and we can talk to you about the 2020 census coming up. So with that being said, I'd like to thank Brother Trainer once again for coming out and joining us and kicking off this new decade.
It's been a real treat, and I'm excited for 2020 and the years ahead, and look forward to doing it shoulder to shoulder with CBTU.
All right. Any last other words?
You know, I've got all kinds of things I'd love to say, but I just want to pick up on what the sister just talked about with the kind of the current state of affairs and, you know, Iran war talk. You know, when I think about what's happening today in the media and what's happening today in communities and the legitimate concerns that are out there, I can't help but think of the intersectionality between the working class struggle and the anti-war struggles of the past. And one of the first things that I ever took part in as an activist was protesting the Iraq War, and then I protested George Bush's inauguration in 2004 in D.C., where there were Iraq protesters everywhere. And you know, I think the beauty of the struggle for justice is just that intersectionality, the fact that, you know, the racial, the gender justice struggle, the working class struggle, the anti-war struggle are so connected, and it's all rooted in a moral sense of justice. And I'm really proud to be a part of that as a working class activist.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The fight is worth it. Keep fighting.
State of Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Keep fighting.
Well, okay. Well, that's our show tonight. I'd like to once again thank Brother Trainer. I'd like to thank our listeners for tapping in tonight. And holla.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all all-night driver out in your cab alone. To you waiting for lunch break as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
The Corvallis Daytime Drop-In Center wouldn't exist without the local folks who volunteer their time to help the homeless. In episode 4 of the third season of Local Folks Podcast, we meet Tiana, Pete, and John to learn what they do, why they volunteer, and what they have learned about the homeless and themselves as a result. You can find Local Folks at kboo.fm. Go to audio, podcasts, and click on Local Folks.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening and welcome to Prison Pipeline. Tonight, I'm very lucky to be here with Terrence Sampson from All Youth Matter. Terrence, welcome to Prison Pipeline.
Thank you, Emma. It was a pleasure.
So, Terrence, you got a master's degree in prison.
Yes, I did.
And you're running a program to help incarcerated youth. Let's start with that. Tell me a little bit about what is All Youth Matter.
Well, All Youth Matter is a project that we started while I was in prison. And the goal of All Youth Matter was to provide curricula and programming that would help children to understand the consequences of their actions, but to also teach them empathy. And so whereas you have a lot of programming that focuses on, you know, what a child should and shouldn't do, well, the difference between us is that we teach a child what they should or shouldn't do, but we also give them the victim side of the story. Because without developing empathy and without understanding the true consequences of your actions, and how they affect your victims, I don't think that you really can help a child, you know, to have that type of thinking process that will prevent them from doing some of the things that hurt other people. So
what are some of the tools that you use in order to help teach children those important lessons of empathy?
Okay, well, we have 7 different programs that, you know, that range from anger management to self-awareness, identity, belief system. But we have a board game that we created called Stacking Paper. And what Stacking Paper does, it allows a child to be one of 3 characters. A child can be a hustler, a child can be a college kid, or a child can be a professional. And so each one of these characters has a distinct role in the game of what they can and can't do. And so what we do that because we want the children to be comfortable